You're listening to episode 21 of The Pulplit Pulpit, and I'm your host, Sam Olson. This week, J.M. Landels reads from the next part of Elenia's song, and Mel Anastasia brings us the next chapter of Stella Ryman and the Fairmount Manor Mysteries. The digital and print versions of both novels are available from our online bookstore at pulpliterature.com. In this episode, our editors discuss the concept of write what you know, and Cadence Mandibura takes on the pulp questionnaire. Later in the episode, I'll answer a listener's question and bring you a tip from your writing muse. To have your writerly question featured and to hear more from the writing muse, visit us on Instagram at pulpliterature. In this episode of Elenia's Song Overture, Elenia bids farewell to her family and makes the sea voyage to Raren.
Elenia's Song Overture by J.M. Landels. Verse 15, Farewells. I woke after an hour or two of sleep with Alan retugging me out of bed. Get up, lazy. Don't you know what day it is? We're leaving this morning. Tired, cranky, with a headache hovering nearby, the words slipped my tongue. I am. You're not. I regretted them instantly. His face mutated through blank incomprehension, fear, suspicion, and finally anger. You're lying, he shouted. An unfamiliar burst of sympathy softened me. I'm sorry, I said inadequately. It's true. Go ask Mama. Breakfast in the small hall was subdued despite the clamor from the rest of the castle as servants and men-at-arms packed mules, saddled horses, and checked quarters for forgotten belongings. Mama was red-eyed and stony-faced, her thoughts impossible to divine. Grandpapa frowned into his porridge and said little. Alan Rhys's face was tear-stained, but he held himself in a rigid, non-committal pose. He was not serving our grandfather this morning. The kitchen maid did that. My sisters as well were quiet for a change, oppressed by the mood around us. I ate sparingly, nervously. Angeli was nowhere to be seen. It was well into morning when our retinue set forth from Osthane's gates. Soot had to jiggle along in his uncompromising trot to keep up with the long-legged destriers, but I did not intend to fall to the back of the line with pack mules. To my relief, Riadne had been chosen to be my escort to Raren, and her bay mare ambled alongside Soot, her hound Nuska trotting ahead. Normally, I would have been full of chatter and questions on such a ride, but today I didn't trust my voice. There was still a largish lump in my throat, and I fought hard against the image of home that kept pushing itself into my mind. I didn't dare turn to look backward for fear I might gallop after my gaze. The departure replayed itself over and over in my mind. The cheerful and indifferent goodbyes from my sisters were easiest to take. The gruff one from Master Barath was suitably distant as well. Willits was attending council, but had bid a respectful farewell the previous day. Mother, who had been tense and preoccupied all morning, wept openly and hugged me hard, almost dragging me off Soot's back. Angeli, as weary as I from our late night, shielded her face from the bright morning sun with a hooded cloak, smiled wanly, and gave me a wordless kiss. It was no more nor less than her usual good-night kiss, and this was more reassuring than anything. But it was Alan Ray's reaction that stayed in my mind. By the time I'd been ready to leave, he had transformed his disappointment into superiority. He was going to be a page for our High Prince of Arrak, while I was only going to stay with Grandpapa. It didn't matter that Grandpapa was a High Prince as well, and that Alan Ray's appointment to Vishad would not be confirmed for a year. Alanry needed his posting to be more glamorous than mine. His strutting, which on most days would have provoked nasty one-upmanship from me, I ignored. When I passed him the ring that Angeli and I had spent the night enchanting, his eyes widened. I didn't think he'd ever experienced such generosity from me before. We looked at each other, truly absorbing the other's face for the first time in many years. Subtle prejudice slipped away and left us familiar strangers. Shy and quiet, we said our goodbyes and parted. Our route took us east, then northwest, up to the port of Oray. After the attack on Grandpapa's party near the Valnerata, Mother would not countenance us using the overland route, or even taking ship at Warencross so close to the borders. The island of Oray was only a little further from Teli than Warencross, and on a good horse with an early start the trip could be made in under a day. With our late leaving, though, and the slow pace of the mules, it was long past sundown when we disembarked from the Oray ferry and settled the horses with the ostler. The soldiers and knights seemed unaffected by the long ride, but I was aching. It felt as if Soot's merciless trot had driven my seat bones up to my shoulders, and my legs were so splayed from its fat barrel that I walked like a duck. But the relief I felt when I slid from his back was double-edged. I wrapped my arms around his neck and buried my face in his winter brown hair that still covered his sleeker summer coat. "Thank you," I whispered, as I always did after a ride. This time the words encompassed more. I wished our last ride could have been a wild romp through the forest or across the commons with the wind in our manes, not this long, uncomfortable journey. Soot would be taken back with the unloaded mules once we were aboard the ship. There was room on board for war horses, but not for children's ponies. I knew my sojourn in Brandyshire was only temporary, but somehow this farewell with Soot seemed final. My intuition was far less precise than Angeli's, but I felt deep within me that I'd never sit on his back again. Two storm crows of loss and loneliness settled on my shoulders, and the tears I'd held back all day burst forth, soaking my face as I rubbed his sweat-curled hide dry. On the 10th morning after we had set sail, Grandpapa came below to wake me and urged me to wash my face, comb my hair, and change into better clothes. Before he left, he hugged me close and hard, and for the life of me I could not think why his embrace also felt like a farewell. The bells of Rarin, high and silvery, unlike the deep-voiced ones of Teli, rang out twice in the time I stood impatiently at the ship's rail. My pack of belongings was at my feet, and Nuska sat patiently between Riadne and me. There was nothing for us to do but wait as the war horses were unloaded, groomed, and saddled. Riadne had left her mare behind, too. I wondered if she missed her as keenly as I missed Soot. She propped her elbows on the rail, bending her tall form in half, and stared at the glittering white city rising up from the shore. Like Teli, Rarin was built up the sides of a hill, with its castle mounted crown-like on the summit, but there the similarity ended. Teli sat nestled in the arms of the great forest, farms and fields rolling westward under its watchful gaze, the mountains a solid, comforting backdrop in the east. Rarin, however, was alone in its landscape, the highest point, the dominant presence. Behind it stretched unlimited tracts of farmland, orchards, and grassland. Before it lay the calm, flat water of the Brona Seaban, another markless horizon. In the midst of this plain of sea and land sat the city with its sugary pink and white stone, fluttering banners and colorful striped awnings. It seemed both vulnerable and arrogant, a shining carbuncle left unguarded on the tabletop, challenging the honesty of dinner guests. The jewel of Brandyshire, however unprotected by its geography, was not without its own defenses. Once the entourage was finally assembled, with Grandfather and his knights mounted on their restless and skittery chargers, and the remainder of us following on foot, we made our way through the port and up to the sea gate. We had passed through one set of gates already when our ship had entered the walled harbor, but this second portal, though narrow, was more formidable than any I had seen before. Two square towers arose on either side, each nearly as tall as the lighthouse beyond the harbor. They were peppered with arrow slits and had scorpions protruding from their upper peaks. They supported a massive drawbridge and two huge portcullises that harbored murder holes between them. And yet, from many of the arrow slits, like cheery gouts of blood, hung potted geraniums. I spluttered and laughed out loud at this incongruous sight, drawing quizzical looks from Riadne and disapproving ones from the rest of the marchers. Then we were inside, proceeding along a low, wide road that turned and emptied us onto the high street. The city was even more marvelous up close. Between the crowded walls of Teli there were no trees or gardens, save for those within the castle yards. In Rarin, window boxes overflowed with flowers, potted roses and vines climbed beside brightly painted doorways, and open gates allowed glimpses into sunny courtyards where fruit trees bloomed, fountains burbled, and unfamiliar birds sang. The people were the most entrancing of all. Crowds had gathered along the high street, lining it with an ever-thickening throng as we passed. Rarin, as the capital city of Brandyshire and a busy seaport, had access to fabrics and dyes that Teli, tucked away in the middle of Arrak, seldom saw. And the citizens of Rarin had no hesitation in displaying their wealth of fashion. Even the commoners all seemed to have some flash of color. Here a twist of cyan ribbon, there a crimson headscarf, a flash of purple mantle, or jaunty rooster feather. The closer to the castle we drew, the richer and more elaborate the costumes became. I marveled at it all while trying to maintain my dignity and not goggle like a bumpkin. By the time we reached the castle gates, I was thoroughly ashamed of my plain and travel-worn tunic, and wished I'd brought my gold and burgundy dress. It was too small now, but I would have held my breath and borne it in order to make a better impression amid the glories of Raron. Once through the gates of the outer bailey, the prince's bastion loomed, even more impressive than when seen from the harbour. Its walls, like that of most of the town, were shades of coral, sand, and white, though bands of dark green stone had been used for decorative effect in the prince's keep and newer towers. Old stonework, humble and moss-covered, still showed around the foot of the bastion, betraying its pre-imperial age. The track wound between the upper and inner bailey, past stables, kennels, yards, and gardens. It was flanked along the way by the various quarters of tradespeople, artisans, smiths, and wheelwrights, burners, ostlers, falconers, and fowlers, tailors, weavers, and spinners, brewers, vintners, millers, and butchers. Each jostled with the other against the walls, forgoing more spacious city quarters for the prestige of royal appointment. All these fell away as the track rose through the outer courtyard to the main entrance, which was almost level with the tops of the curtain wall. Here courtiers fanned out on either side of the wide oaken portal, a festive peacetime version of an honor guard. In the center of this peacock array stood the Princess Royal, Lady Gwanin d'Aresti, my grandfather's wife. The riders in the party dismounted and dropped to one knee as grandfather swung a slow leg over the saddle. Radney's hand pushed down on my shoulder and I knelt awkwardly. It was the first time I'd bent my knee to anyone, and it did not come naturally. I kept my head lowered at what I hoped was the correct angle, all the while peering from beneath my hair at the scene unfolding. Grandfather strolled up the steps of his home, the courtiers curtsying and bowing in a ripple that converged on his wife, who gave a gentle dip. He took her hand and kissed it, after which they exchanged a cheek-to-cheek embrace on either side. It seemed as if she whispered something, but I couldn't be sure, nor could I hear if he replied. In a loud voice he said, "It is good to see you again, my lady." "And you also, my lord. Will your knights sup with us?" "They will." With this ritual exchange complete, the prince and princess turned and entered the palace. There was a flurry of movement as grooms appeared, porters moved baggage, and the entourage dispersed to various quarters, leaving Riadne, Nuska, and me abandoned at the beginning of the grand colonnaded walk leading to the prince's tower. She smiled down at me reassuringly. "I doubt they've forgotten us, pup," she said, squeezing my shoulders. A figure in a liveried tabard emerged from the cloistered walk on the left and approached with crisp, businesslike stride. "Allegna Andrig," she looked down on me with cool eyes set in a face planed from stone. I tried to look imperious, a difficult task when I was head and shoulders shorter than my addresser. "I am she." "Page's quarters are that way," she pointed down the walkway from which she'd emerged, then turned to Riadne. "Captain Tremarian." "That's me," Riadne smiled, shouldering her pack once more. The girl bowed slightly, hand over heart, in the Brandishere custom. I was taken aback. She had bowed to Riadne and not to me. "Commander Vanieri is having your letters of commission drawn up. Will you accompany me?" Riadne turned back to me and ruffled my hair, something I hated but tolerated only from her. "See you later, little bird," she said, and followed the emissary along the cloister opposite. I stood stunned. Nuska nosed my hand, then trotted after her mistress. The words "letter of commission" circled noiselessly in my head in search of meaning. Finally, like a bell striking, sense and words united, and I grasped what should have been obvious all along. Riadne had mentioned several times, both before and during the voyage, how limited her opportunities for advancement in Arrak were, how many more women, soldiers, knights, and rangers there were in Brandishere. But the obvious conclusion had escaped me till now. She was transferring allegiance, taking a new commission in Brandishere. It was a devastating revelation. There had been no reason to assume Riadne had been sent only to be my companion. But in my self-involved world, there had been no reason to assume she had not. Bustle and activity swirled past me in this busy intersection as I slowly took in how truly alone I was.
Thanks so much, Jen. You can find Alania's Song Overture and the sequel, Alania's Song Aria, in our bookstore at pulpliterature.com.
All right, today on our second installment of what the editors think are the most overrated pieces of writing advice, I have editors Jen Landels, Brooklyn Hook, Genevieve Wynand, and Mel Anastasia to discuss writing what you know. Jen, what's the first thing that comes to mind when you take inventory of the advice, write what you know?
Well, on the surface, it's kind of ridiculous for a fantasy and historical writer like myself, because... If we all took that advice verbatim, there would be no fantasy or science fiction. Or, I think it's a good piece of advice for writers starting out who don't know where to start. And I think that's the way it was originally intended, because, you know, we all have our own stories and our own voices, and only we can tell those stories in our voices. So I think that's the intent behind Write What You Know. But I think it's become a very limiting piece of advice, because it stops writers from, you know, writing outside their own experience.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And, you know, I agree that there are certain areas in which people are experts, and we should maybe like look to those people and let them write about, you know, their experiences and using their knowledge and research and things like that. But especially in this day and age when we have access to the internet, research is so easy. Of course, you have to do good research, but, you know, like an example that I always think about for myself is that I was writing this story about a woman who had like promised her firstborn child to some entity. And I know nothing about pregnancy. I've never been pregnant. I don't have like, a lot of my friends have not had children. And I was researching up a storm, Googling all of these things about, you know, when people start to show and things like that. And like, I couldn't write that from my own personal experience, but there's tons of credible, you know, articles online about things like that from all kinds of perspectives, from medical perspectives to, you know, people who share their personal stories and things like that. So, you know, I really agree that writing what you know is a good place to start, but why limit yourself, you know?
Absolutely. I love that that example that you gave, Brooklyn. And I think when I encounter the advice, write what you want to know, I always sort of flip it a little bit and think of write toward what you want to discover. Sometimes it is nuts and bolts and solid research. Sometimes I think maybe a little bit more in the case of poetry, for example, there's surprises that await us where we don't have to have all the research done and the answers made, and we can sort of have a sense of what we're diving into and see what comes up along the way. So I think what you both have touched on so far is really important. I think the genre we're writing in is going to nudge the idea of write what you know into one direction or into the complete opposite.
Yeah, and I think the question of research with Write What You Know is a really interesting one too, because I would be inclined to kind of refashion that advice as write what you're interested in researching or write what you're comfortable researching, mm-hmm. and kind of let that drive you, because I am always paranoid when I'm writing that I don't know what I don't know. And that is like, that's one of my biggest anxieties as a writer, actually, is making some historical blunder of not knowing what I'm talking about. So I think that, and like what you were saying, Brooklyn, about how easy it is to do research now with the internet literally at your fingertips, it's the write what you know advice kind of has to be refashioned a little bit by that reality.
Yeah, you know, it's funny with so much a great fantasy and so many great fantasy authors out there. It's amazing. You never hear them saying, don't write anything you know. Make everything up. You never hear them saying that. I wonder why it's all one side. But yeah, and you think about it. Like I write a lot of stuff set in the 1930s movies era. And the big thing that agents and publishers always want to know is, you didn't put too much stuff in, did you? So I spent my life, you know, building all this background knowledge. But I think it would be helpful, you know, writing what you know, to just as Brooklyn said, to move into knowing what sorts of things you have to have for world building. So taking the sort of ratio of fact to what's going into a story set in actual history with all the research. Taking that same ratio and moving it into building a science fiction or fantasy world. I think that'd be really fun to do.
Well, it's interesting too, because what we know is not just stuff. Sometimes what we know is emotion and feeling and longing and heartache. And so Brooklyn, in your example with pregnancy, you, I guess, needed to look up the, you know, what happens over the 40 weeks and trying to get yourself in that mindset. But I'm sure you know what it is to care about something, you know, mm-hmm. And to, you know, about expectation and other things. So it's really this sort of interesting multi-layered thing that sometimes what we know is the heart of what we're writing. We just need to learn, I guess, the meat of it.
I wonder if it isn't kind of old-fashioned advice. I don't know if you guys ever read that old book, Up the Down Staircase, but one of the characters is a teacher who is always writing romantic thrillers set in Polynesian islands when he was in New York secondary school with tons of problems there. And they kept saying to him, write what you know, write what you know. So maybe that comes from the past.
But I mean, let's be honest, a trip to Hawaii to learn a little bit about Polynesian culture, that would be research time well spent.
Mm. Exactly.
That's all go.
But there's the other thing too, is that when you're writing in a fantasy world, I find the parts of your made up world that are the best are the parts that the author does know. So even though, you know, you've made up a system of magic or you've made up a geography, you can sometimes tell, like, when a particular geography is something close to the writer's heart, because all of a sudden you are there in that place and you can smell the what the air smells like, mm-hmm. and what the sun feels like. You know, for example, in Elenia's song, the system of magic is obviously made up because, you know, magic is not real, or, you know, nobody can actually sing music into magic. But what I do know is music, because I used to be a musician. And so I could draw on my music knowledge to inform how the magic worked in this, you know, made up world.
Yeah, that specialist knowledge that is so important in so many genres. I'm thinking of the Connolly Bosch novels, where the expertise in the police system and the legal system is just so enriches, and he clearly knows it.
And you can tell.
Yeah.
You can tell he knows it. You can really tell when an author knows what they're talking about. So I guess in that case, you know, write what you know does work in that instance.
I think write what you know and is good advice for as a reminder that there is stuff that you do know and that there is stuff that you can find out, but then there is stuff you need to leave out. And that's, I think we've talked about that in other chats before, but that's sort of always the sticking point is, maybe it's wonderful to amass this great deal of knowledge, but then use it to inform your writing in a way that you still have the sort of, you have the concision and brevity of an expert. But you're not sort of bogged down as if it's, you know, a lecture series that you're now giving to your reader. It's a very tricky balancing act, which of course we all know and have discussed before.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of accidentally giving readers like little history lectures and stuff. but I think you can always definitely tell when an author knows their stuff, and you can also tell when they know something so well that they're leaving things out that they know that you don't need to know. It's mm-hmm. kind of like you can sense their expertise. I'm not really sure how, I can't quite put that into words, but you can just tell when an author has spent weeks looking up the geography of like one particular mountain range. It just kind of seeps into the prose kind of magically.
And like, you know, like we kind of keep circling back to, they might not have had any of that knowledge when they set out to write anything. And I'm sure we've all had that experience. I know that I will often be writing something and think I just need to kind of Google that up a little bit and just figure out if that is what it is that I'm trying to say, or if I do need to have a little bit more knowledge, let alone for those of you that write, you know, deep dives into things that do require, you know, weeks and weeks of research. But it doesn't mean you have to know it all before you dive in.
Yes. And I think the other cautionary bit of advice would be, instead of just write what you know, go ahead, write about what you don't know.
Mm.
But like Sam said, be aware that you might not know what you don't know.
And your readers might know it.
But your readers might know it. And the classic example, I'm on so many panels at conferences and things, is about horses, because horses turn up in fantasy. They turn up in historical fiction. And those of us who are horse people can instantly tell whether an author knows horses when they're writing horses or whether they don't.
That seems like a bit of a cautionary tale to those who choose to submit to pulp literature. Be careful. Be careful before you click submit, folks.
But there are some subjects like that. Again, medical subjects, a doctor or nurse reading medical jargon will instantly know whether the writer has some firsthand experience or not. So, maybe the advice should not be write what you know, but just be cautious when writing about what you don't know.
Yeah, I think that's a great point that kind of also ties into, you have to learn how to research to then be a good writer in a fantasy genre. You can't really cut any corners on that research, because some stuff is just so specific. And of course, there are always people out there that will know more about something. But one of the most recent examples that I think is hilarious is John Boyne, who's one of my favorite writers. In one of his most recent books, he was trying to find what a recipe for red dye would have been like in biblical times. And it made it through all rounds of editing, and he ended up publishing a book with a red dye recipe from a Legend of Zelda video game. He at least had a sense of humor about, but what a blunder.
Oh, that is so meta.
But amazing book still, but just stuff like that absolutely keeps me up at night.
Terrified.
Thank goodness for good copy editors.
Indeed.
And I think it's interesting, like what Genevieve was talking about earlier about, you know, writing about things that you want to discover. It's I was chatting with one of the authors we did a critique for, and an article had come across her desk at work about something super fascinating. I think it had to do with like forensic accounting, and it was kind of related to her story. And it was kind of like a little bonus research for her story that was part of her kind of professional development. And I think things like that are so cool, like articles that inform your writing. Like, there's just so much out there. And if, like Sam was saying, if you do your diligent research, you can write about anything almost.
Mm-hmm. And there are little outs you can take too, like thinking of Lee Child, the British writer who writes Jack Reacher, the American hero. But he does not take for granted that he knows what went on in the States when Jack Reacher was young. So he has him growing up in army towns all over the world. So he didn't get that basic Pepsodent commercial type thing that anybody would know that grew up when Jack Reacher grew up.
That was very wise of him.
Very clever. Mm-hmm. Whereas there's a really wonderful British-based detective story written by an American woman who I love, but my husband, who's British, just goes, <That's>, no. Gotta be careful.
Yes, you do have to be careful, especially with regional things.
Yeah, she's made $1 zillion, though. So mm-hmm.
I Has anyone discovered what they don't know?
But then you know it. What's that about?
Well, I had to learn. I mean, I've had to learn a whole bunch about the 17th century. And I keep learning more and more because I'll be writing along and then I'll do those infamous square brackets with the word research in them. And then I think I'm done with the story or the section or whatever. And then I go back to edit and I say, oh, research. And then I research and then I have to go through and change a whole bunch of things. So yeah, I learn a lot about what I didn't know. And there's probably still, I'm sure somebody who's, 17th century French history expert would be able to pick a dozen things out of any one of my Toinette stories.
Yeah, this is the one of the most embarrassing things about me, I think, which is that any time I have a car in a short story, I have to Google literally everything about cars. I barely know how to put gas in a car. That's where my knowledge stops. So like any time a vehicle is referenced, I'm like trying to scroll through just pages of car guys talking about car parts, which is almost unintelligible. And I just kind of have to trust that whatever term this man who works at AutoZone is using is
How many times does a car or does driving come up in your writing?
Not often enough to justify my anxiety over like the type of car. Like it's just, oh my God, it's so embarrassing. I don't know why it's like, it's, I just can't, if I had to think of a car off the top of my head, wouldn't be able to do it. Couldn't name one type of car.
Sam, yeah. I think you need to switch to writing SF.
Yeah.
Far future SF. So they don't even have the word car.
Post automobile.
Yeah, no cars involved. I'll make a new genre that's just post automobile. That's it.
There you go.
Now it's my pleasure to introduce writer Cadence Mandibura. Cadence is a Victoria-based writer and editor whose work has been published in Freefall, Fudoki Magazine, and the Bacopa Literary Review. We were lucky enough to publish Cadence's gorgeous pieces, The Weeping Pools and River's 1001 Voice, in Pulp Literature Issue 29. The Weeping Pools was also the winner of the Hummingbird Flash Fiction Prize in 2020. When Cadence isn't writing, you can find her practicing martial arts or playing Japanese taiko drums. To learn more about what Cadence is up to, check out her website, cadencemandibura.com. We asked Cadence to complete our pulp questionnaire, and here's what she had to say. We hope you enjoy.
My name is Cadence Mandibura. I am a writer and editor, originally from Calgary. I now live in Victoria, BC, on the unceded traditional territories of the Lekwungen-speaking peoples, including the Songhees and Esquimalt nations. As a writer, I write a bit of a broad range of things, but it's usually literary, speculative. I write fabulism. A lot of my stuff has a dose of humor in there. I rarely write straight fiction because I love the imaginative possibilities of writing. So I always try to add at least a little bit of magic in everything I write.
Would you rather, on reading your published work, find a typo in the first sentence or the last?
This is a tricky question because both options of having a typo in the first sentence and the last sentence are terrible. But I would say I would rather have a typo in the last sentence. The first sentence is the first impression you make on a reader, and it would be really sad to start on a sour note. If the reader sees a typo in the first sentence, they may not even read on for the rest of the story, whereas if they've made it all the way to your very last sentence, perhaps they can simply see the humor in the fact that there's a typo there. Hopefully your story will still be resonant despite that typo and that final impression, but yes, I would have to say the last sentence.
At which stage would you rather be rejected? Query, initial submission, revisions, or final manuscript?
Well, nobody likes to think about rejection, but the beautiful thing about rejection, if there is anything beautiful about it, are the times where you have an opportunity to get some feedback and revisit your writing and make it stronger. So in looking at these options about where I would want to get rejected, I would say somewhere between the initial submission and the revisions, because at that point, someone has actually read your work. They have actually shown at least a little bit of interest in what you're trying to do. And at that stage, you have some information as a writer from that particular reader to improve the work or to at least re-examine it and revisit it and make it stronger. That said, getting rejected in deep into revisions or certainly at the final manuscript sounds extremely painful because after going through all that work, getting it to a final manuscript and then still being told that it is not adequate, that I think I would rather get rejected at the query than the final manuscript.
With whom would you like your work compared?
So the answer to this question, I suspect, will change as I read more writers, and as I grow myself as a writer. But today, the writers I would like my work compared with are Haruki Murakami, H.G. Wells, Richard Wagamese, Kate Atkinson, Jonathan Goldstein, Joyce Carol Oates, and there are probably others I couldn't think of, but I think that's a pretty solid list to start out with.
Who are your trusted first readers?
So my dear friend, Manera, has been championing my writing since the very beginning, since I was a teenager, and she has been there for me for the decades since then. She is my most trusted reader because, first of all, she genuinely enjoys my writing, which I think is important, but she understands what I'm trying to do as a writer and how I'm trying to grow. So she gives me the best feedback. She's also not afraid to tell me when I am missing the mark or when I need to improve and what I need to work on. So she is my number one trusted reader. I'm also very fortunate to be part of a strong local group. We've of course been meeting virtually during the pandemic, but it's still been going strong. I hear so many horror stories about critique partners or, you know, writers groups. And I'm so grateful for the writers I know. Not only are they excellent writers, but they give such clear, supportive, constructive feedback. They have all helped me grow as a writer over the years, and I'm sure will continue to do so for many, many years as I continue writing.
In a movie based on your writing career, what would the subtitle be?
In Progress, because that's how I feel as a writer anyway.
Where do you do your most productive writing?
So the answer to this is a bit more of a when than a where. So I do most of my work at my kitchen table, and I'm lucky to have these big east-facing windows. So when it's a sunny day, I get this gorgeous pool of sunlight on my kitchen table first thing in the morning. And that's where I do my best writing, is in the sunlight. Usually when I'm actually hand writing or hand editing something compared to working on a computer, and with some, you know, fresh hot coffee. So that's where I do my most productive writing.
What to writing is your greatest distraction? What gets you back to the page?
So my greatest distraction, other than the common distractions of checking my email or checking Reddit, that sort of thing, but it's actually what I would consider ancillary writing activities. So I love the craft of writing. I love talking about writing. I love reading about writing. I edit for a living. You know, I often have friends' writings to read and critique. All of those things that certainly support my career as a writer are still not quite the same as actually just buckling down and working on my project. So I find when I'm procrastinating and I'm trying to avoid whatever is difficult about the project I'm working on, that's where I tend to go, are these writing adjacent activities that are can still convince myself are helpful, but are not actually moving me forward in whatever piece I'm working on. So that is my greatest distraction. In terms of what gets me back to the page, other than deadlines, which work brilliantly when I owe something to someone else, such as a writer's group, or I'm trying to meet a submission deadline, those are very motivating. But what gets me back to the page is literally just starting. Like if I can get through 2 minutes or 5 minutes working on a project, suddenly I get swept away again. So there's this inertia of that's preventing me from starting. And then once I start, the inertia flips and I get momentum and I move forward. So, you know, that I guess that's what keeps me on the page once I get back there. But if I can rationally convince myself just to do 5 minutes of work, that will usually turn into much more than 5 minutes of work.
Which unknown literary work should be known and read widely?
So I'm going to pick a pretty old example, but it is one I wish people, or I would like people to engage with more, and that's Measure for Measure by Shakespeare. So it's not one of his most popular plays. It's actually considered a problem play, which I actually kind of love about it. And it's certainly not as beautiful or deep as many of his great tragedies. But Measure for Measure, it is what I would consider a Renaissance Me Too play. It deals with power dynamics and sex, and it's so interesting. I love the characters. I love the central topics it deals with. I saw it as a teenager, and it affected me greatly then, and I keep returning to it because I find it fascinating. And for anyone who is interested in Me Too literature or power dynamics or hypocritical villains, it's a good one. So I recommend Measure for Measure by Shakespeare.
What was the last book you recommended to a friend? To a stranger?
The Farm by Joanne Ramos. It is the best book I've read this year. It was a stay up past my bedtime read. It's about this boutique surrogacy agency where rich clients pay, you know, not so rich women to bear their children for them. And it's one of those brilliant speculative fiction books that is so close to reality, it's chilling. And it's just she has excellent characters. It's so cleanly written. It's exciting. It's fascinating. I thought about it for days. I've recommended it to everyone I saw after I read it. So I recommend it highly. The Farm by Joanne Ramos.
When reading, do you prefer footnotes or endnotes?
Footnotes. I understand that endnotes maybe look a little cleaner on the page, but I have always found footnotes to be so much more practical for the reader. I am also a fan of Terry Pratchett, and I love how he uses footnotes for comedic effect.
How do you organize your bookshelf?
So I organize my books by subject and then by author name. So my nonfiction is loosely categorized into the different subjects of the books that I own. And then all my fiction is together, and that just goes by last name. So it's a little boring, but it's, you know, it works. I do love people who organize their bookshelves by color. I adore the pictures of rainbow bookshelves. I personally do not have the organizational skill to pull that off, but I'm so glad other people do because it's gorgeous.
Thank you so much for your wonderful responses, Cadence. Remember, you can learn more about what Cadence is up to on her website, cadencemandibura.com. Now here's Mel with the next chapter of Stella Ryman and the Fairmount Manor Mysteries.
This is Mel Anastasia, reading from Stella Ryman and the Fairmount Manor Mysteries, published by Pulp Literature Press. This is part 2 of The Poison Pen Affair. Mrs. Stella Ryman, having observed the arrival of a mysterious envelope under the door of her bedroom at Fairmount Manor, is reminded of the letter that sent her into the state of panic and all the way to Fairmount a few months earlier. However, this envelope is addressed with cut-out letters from a magazine, like a ransom note, and she's just about to investigate the contents when she hears a care worker at the door. Cheryl poked her head through the door into Stella's room. Just her head, one shoulder of her blue teddy bear smock showing. At least twice a day, Stella thanked her stars the care worker was back after her recent trials. "Just as I thought, you're awake," Cheryl said. "Mrs. Ryman, you've got the jump on us all again. While the rest of the world is rising, will you walk with me to breakfast? I'll pour you an early cup of tea." "How kind of you," Stella said with all the politeness her mother's upbringing had taught her, for that mysterious envelope called to her from between the covers of the Prisoner of Zenda on her bedside table. Who would have gone to the trouble of clipping out the letters comprising her name and then gluing each one of them on? What if she'd had a longer name than Stella? What if she'd been named Philomena or Genevieve? Then what then? Would the sender have gone to all the trouble of clipping out one by one the letters would make up a longer name? All these questions beg for answers. Yet after all the trouble Cheryl had so recently endured, Stella could not possibly refuse the invitation. Cheryl held the door for Stella, who shuffled along the corridor at Cheryl's side. "You look pretty today, Mrs. Ryman," Cheryl said. "Thank you, dear," Stella sighed. "Pretty meant something quite different now from when she was young." She looked down at herself to see what she had dressed herself in today. It was one of her stretchy two-piece warm-up sets,
tan stretch linen look, the catalog had called it, and it was a far cry from the other offer in this style, which thankfully she had resisted, floral multi. At work or at home back in her lifetime, Stella would not have been caught dead in a Richmond ditch in one of these samey-samey creations, nor these awful shuffling beige slip-on shoes. But she had a vague memory of having sent off for them before she'd checked herself into Fairmount Manor. Back then, 3 months before, when Stella was racked with pain and struggling to manage even buttons by herself, elastic waistbands and Velcro closures had enticed her with their siren song of ease. She wondered where her best red cashmere cardigan had gone, bought 40 years ago before that new nonsense cashmere had slinked its way onto the market with its miraculously low price tag and pillings around the middle and under the arms. Perhaps Junie had her red cardigan? That one and the black one she purchased in that splurge-filled year when she was 48 and so chuffed that she still had her figure. The forest green one she really missed was older still. She'd had it the year her husband left, and Junie, still a baby, had burped up on it, though the cleaners had done wonders. And where had her lovely wool skirts gone? Les jupes d'antan, pleated plaid in misty heather colors, their seams double-stitched and no chance of cold sneaking up on you, except for a rogue breeze from underneath. But Cheryl was speaking to her. I heard you had a chat with the director on my behalf. Cheryl gave Stella her beautiful smile, and her next words were truly a gift. Thank you. It's so nice to have somebody willing to stand by me. Not at all, Stella hesitated. Was your husband pleased at the way things turned out? Yes, of course. Thank you for asking. But Cheryl's words had followed a telling pause. Something's up, Stella thought. But before she could find a tactful way to pursue the subject, they had reached the staff room door. There they encountered Reliza. Stella saw that the girl was wearing that old yellow smock again. Curse it! But then it might not be one of handsome Dr. Terry's days at Fairmount. When Stella and Cheryl greeted Reliza, the young care worker hardly glanced at them. All her attention was upon the piece of paper she held in one hand. The other hand held an envelope. Letters came from people every day, of course, more via computer than on paper these days, of course. Still, Stella frowned over the coincidence as she walked on at Cheryl's side. Then a chenille-robed resident, one whose name Stella didn't remember, called out to Cheryl from the door. With apologies, the care worker darted away to help the other woman. Stella walked on alone to breakfast. At this hour, Corridor Park was uninhabited, as was the corridor outside the dining room. Even though it was not what you would call a thrill, Stella was enjoying being the first one up and out from Daffodil Corridor all on her own. It reminded her of her teaching days, during report card season, when enrolling teachers swept in late and inky-fingered so that she, their school librarian, walked the halls alone on morning duty. The solitude never lasted, of course. A boys' basketball team would bang through the front door, shouting, swinging their gym bags at each other's shins. A little later, she would see a second larger rush of children, red-cheeked after their wait outside, ripping off their coats as they sped towards their classrooms like junior businessmen, late for work. Stella wished a kerfuffle of 9-year-olds would dash around the corner into Corridor Park later today to disturb the Greek chorus sitting hunched over their needlework. She imagined the scene and the fuss that Ailanth, Lucille, and the Nodder would make. She laughed aloud. It occurred to her that even though she sometimes left her room early, she'd never been the first to breakfast before. This was entirely due to the maze-like corridors of Fairmount, and she felt fortunate that Cheryl had dropped her off so close to the dining room. For now, she asked herself a question. If she arrived first for breakfast, might she not get the first piece of toast? It might be crisp. She supposed that warm was too much to ask for, but Stella paused, gobsmacked, as a brand new thought presented itself to her. If she really was first to breakfast, she would have the heaven-sent opportunity of making a foray on table 8, where the Greek chorus always sat, hogging all the little plastic containers of marmalade to themselves. Until this moment, Stella had not fathomed how unhappy it made her to be always stuck with strawberry or, worse, peach, or, worse still, grape jelly. Stella shuddered. She pushed open the door into the dining room. Just inside the room, she paused for a moment, taking in the empty tables and the shining serving counter with its line of chrome trays. Neither of the cooks was in sight. Stella set her shoulders for a raid on table 8. She should have done this months ago. She made her way to the Greek chorus's table and took the top off the plastic container holding the little packets of jams and jellies. She removed 5 marmalades from their supply, and another to make a rounded even number 6. She hid the packets in her pocket, telling herself that she was becoming quite the little thief. But was it really thievery? The tea bags and the blue mug that she'd stolen from the staff room and hidden under the art table in the storage room might reasonably be called swag, even though the mug was chipped. But a raid on marmalade was not thievery. It was justice. Taking these packets of golden shred was righting a great wrong. Stella felt that Churchill would have been the first to cheer her on, chewing his fat cigar, raising 2 fingers in a victory V. As well, Churchill had been British and would have valued marmalade on his bit of morning toast and roundly cursed grape jelly. Patting her marmalade-filled pockets, Stella walked over to the window and gazed up through the laurel branches into a pale, sunlit April sky. She could just make out the bit of grass that separated Fairmount Manor from the houses out behind it. She wondered who mowed it and suddenly remembered the sweet, rich smell of cut grass, still wet with dew, and sticking to the sides of her shoes when she used to walk about to school. Behind her, she heard the dining room door open and shut, but she managed to pretend she was still alone until she became aware of a strange noise. She did not at first identify it as human. It sounded more like an animal in pain, but when she turned round, she saw the gasping wheeze was coming from a woman in distress. The Greek chorus member, Stella had nicknamed the Nodder, had come into the dining room and was sitting, curly head bowed, at table 8. Her hands lay flat on the cloth before her. Between her hands, in the place where a breakfast plate belonged, lay a little pile of torn-up paper. At first, Stella was reminded so vividly of her attempts as a girl guide to build fires for her camping badge that she didn't understand. Of course, nobody would be so foolish to think that the Nodder, brows locked, chin trembling, was trying to light a little fire at table 8. The Nodder, her breath labored, stared down at the bits of paper in front of her. The mottled puce of the woman's face was frightening, and the color seemed to Stella's eyes to be deepening. Stella was no doctor, but she identified this as one of those moments that could end badly, very badly, unless somebody took swift action. "Don't move," Stella urged the Nodder. "I'll be right back." She turned and made for the corridor as quickly as her slip-ons would take her. Nor could she take the time to look for Dr. Terry. He was only in Fairmount Manor 1 or 2 days a week, and she didn't know which ones. The office would not yet be open. Her best bet was to find a care worker, and quickly. As she headed away from the dining room, she passed Thelma tapping along on her way to breakfast. Stella asked, "Have you seen Cheryl?" But this appeared to be one of Thelma's deaf mornings. Stella hustled by her, cursing her slip-ons, which she had bought as the most comfortable shoes available, short of slippers. Now that she thought about it, she could see what a small-minded purchase they had been. For Stella was a person who treasured the memory of a pair of coral calfskin pumps that she'd loved like family. Now she wore these idiotic beige slip-ons, and they slowed her steps. Slush, 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 as they went along the corridor. This investigative morning was not right for that sort of sound. This was a moment for the rapid clicking of heels on linoleum, a moment when you wanted to be wearing the sort of shoe that knows its business. However, she was moving as quickly as she could. Where were all the care workers? The hour was still so early that the corridors were empty and Stella passed only closed doors. Roliza, Cheryl, or Ollie could be in any of these rooms helping somebody through their morning wash. Toileting. She knew she ought to hammer on each door in a systematic search, but that would take too long. The Nodder needed help now. Therefore, because Stella couldn't be thorough, She opted instead for logic. 1. Care workers arrived early on the job. 2. Early arrivals necessitated coffee. Stella hurried her shuffling steps along the corridor towards the staff room, trying not to imagine the nodder dying in the dining room with a little pile of ripped-up letter in the table in front of her.
To keep the Stella adventures going, visit our bookstore at pulpliterature.com and pick up your copy of Stella Ryman and the Fairmount Manor Mysteries, as well as the sequel, The Labors of Mrs. Stella Ryman, Further Fairmount Manor Mysteries. So for our listener question today, someone asked, what are some things I can do to break out of my writer's block? I really love this question because I am constantly looking for new ways to get out of that funk where you just can't write anything, all your ideas feel bad, nothing's really coming to the page. And one exercise that I've just tried recently that I've really enjoyed is selecting the first line of a story that you love or a story that you really admire and letting yourself write from that line. I found that it's a lot easier to settle back into the act of writing when you're not the one coming up with those daunting first couple words. And I found that then when I write a piece I like, I can just go back and delete that first line and start with my second or maybe reintroduce an original first line. And this is also a really interesting way to kind of play around with voice and see how you might transition from one author's voice back to your own, or how you might adopt a new voice. And just being able to kind of play around with some new elements in your writing, or to do something you maybe hadn't thought of before, something that might have felt daunting to do in your own voice, can be really freeing, and I found that that has definitely helped me a lot when I don't know what to come to the page with. Thanks so much for that question. And for a chance to hear us discuss your question, message us on Instagram at pulpliterature or email sam.olson@sam@pulpliterature.com. Thank you so much for joining me today, and a big thank you to the Pulp Literature team and our amazing sound engineer, Melissa Gruger. I'm Sam Olson, and I'll see you back for episode 22 to share more stories. I'll leave our last word with our resident writing muse, who you can visit on Twitter at @yourwritingmuse. You write from your heart, and your readers can't stop reading your stories. Here's to another great day in your writing career from your writing muse.